Seattle, Washington, October 10, 1987. This is Side One, a continuing series of tapes with Erling Sanis concerning the organization of the Teamsters in North Dakota, South Dakota, 1937, 38, 39, and 40.
Hello? Jack.
Yes, how are you?
Doing fine. Pretty good, Jack.
Well,
we got kind of a cold spell here in North Dakota.
Oh, yeah? How cold is it? Freezing?
Oh, yeah. We got down to about 12 degrees last night.
Glory be.
Yeah, that's the cold.
Have they got the crops all laid by?
Everything except the sunflowers.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're kind of a late crop anyway.
They had a big crop there now, huh?
Yeah, that was a big sunflower crop. Good crop, too, I think.
Well, we're still having a warm, dry weather here.
Oh, you are?
Now, we were going to talk about what tonight?
Well, I got a few questions.
Fine, go ahead.
Yeah, on South Dakota, and then I was thought maybe I'd ask a few questions.
Okay.
About South Dakota. When did the North Central District Drivers Council cease using that name, Jack?
The North Central District Drivers Council was ordered to disband the council per se.
Yeah, that we talked about.
And that occurred in early January of 1938.
Right.
The next week, we went into Indianapolis.
Uh-huh.
And Tobin gave us the right to organize only the over-the-road motor freight drivers.
Right.
So, officially, when John Picago read that letter, that ended the North Central District Drivers Council formally. But the people referred to it for a long time afterwards.
Okay. But in Farrell's book, I can't really determine when the name was...
Well, formally, we didn't use it. We had letterheads and everything, and after we had the committee set up, we then called it the 11 State... Well, we didn't call it the 11 State Committee over there. We called it the Over-the-Road Negotiating Committee first.
Yeah.
Because we had to go into Chicago in March of 38. The later part of March of 1938. And Sandy O'Brien, who was the business secretary treasurer, or whatever he was, I forget his title. I think he was the president. Tobin had awarded him the jurisdiction of the highway drivers. Prior to that time, most of the over-the-road motor freight companies, there weren't too many of them that had yet established their own big company-owned terminals. They shared terminals with another company, or they rented space in another company.
Yeah.
And so the drivers who were pulling into a dock at 3300 South Iron in Chicago, for instance, whatever jurisdiction the local had in that barn, that's where they went. Up until Sandy got the jurisdiction. And formally then, Red O'Laughlin formally joined there, were representing Michigan, and B.V. Griff come along from Cleveland. And that became the 11 State Committee.
Okay.
And that, the original, I can't give you the exact date, but the 11 State Area Committee was officially named under that over-the-road mailer agreement, the 11 State Area Committee, by the 1st of April, 1938.
Okay.
You see, the contracts read over-the-road motor freight, because that's what precisely Tobin told us we could do. But by then, we called it the 11 State Area Committee. We got 11 people into it, 11 states.
Yeah.
And that happened, I'd say early before or right after April 1, 1938.
Okay, that's close enough. I can look for that.
Yeah, there'll be no dispute on that.
Okay. All right. Next question. Northwest Organizer of March 2nd, 1939.
Mm-hmm.
They report on the formation of a South Dakota State Drivers Council at Watertown.
Mm-hmm.
And you were present there, according to the Northwest Organizer.
What?
You were there to organize the South Dakota State Council.
Well, let me see. I don't know.
Let me just kind of read a little bit of the article. I'm
yeah.
Going back some
all right.
Jack. Sunday, February 26th, drivers' unions from throughout South Dakota met at Watertown.
Yeah, we met in Roy Phillips' home. I remember now.
Well, the state drivers' joint council. Delegates present from locals in Aberdeen, Huron, Sioux Falls, Watertown. Rapid City was unrepresented.
Uh-huh.
Aaron Kruger opened the meeting, and Brother Kruger then turned the meeting over to McCreary, business agent of Sioux Falls.
749.
And Al Russell.
He was the recording secretary of Local 554 in Omaha.
That's right. He talked about the smashing victory they had won there.
Mm-hmm.
After their 152-day strike and so on. And he urged the South Dakota drivers to form a state driving council. And then Jack Maloney of the Local 383 Sioux City, a member of the area committee, reported on your campaign there and told about the aims of the drivers' movement and the present campaign in the Southwest and so on.
Mm-hmm. I remember the meeting, Al. It was before the arrest for the, hello?
Yeah.
It was before the arrest of Fouts and Johnson. Yes, I was still going into South Dakota then.
That's right, because with the truck. So hold on, Jack, I got the call coming in.
Yeah, all right.
On, Jack?
Yeah.
I think that incident with the truck in Sioux Falls was about the 9th of March, apparently a week later.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you remembered anything about that meeting, Jack, in terms of...
Well, about all, I think we held it, if I recall correctly, at Roy Phillips' home in Watertown.
Uh-huh.
And what we done at that time, we reported that we had now successfully concluded all the major holdouts of the interlining big operators.
Uh-huh.
And we said that we would have to now deal with the operators in South Dakota that had not yet inked the agreement.
Right.
And we were pointing out how we would try to do it.
Right.
And we had an expression, we would tackle those that we had the leverage on going into the area where we could control them, Kansas City, Sioux City, Omaha, Minneapolis, Des Moines, and we'd put the pressure on them for their interlining where they had, you know, working with other companies.
Uh-huh.
And if they were going to drop off freight in Sioux Falls or any of these other cities, why, we just go in and hard time them. It was possible to do that then.
Yeah.
We just go in and tell the operator of the terminal, now look, this guy has not signed the agreement.
Uh-huh.
And you have. And if you want to keep operating, you better tell that guy to pack up his little goddamn bundle of freight and get the hell out of here.
Oh, yeah.
And don't you receive it. And don't you pick up nothing and deliver to him. Because we'll just put you out of business. We'll just shut you down wherever we can. And that was our, it was brutal, and it was cold-blooded, but that's the way it had to be.
Did it work?
Well, it worked in most of the cases. Some of the purely intrastate driver companies, they were small, they objected. And as I told you earlier, it wasn't until May of 1940 that we finally succeeded and tying up the loose ends in South Dakota with the intrastate drivers.
Uh-huh.
And we held some meetings in Minneapolis and subsequently in Sioux City. Because I wouldn't go into South Dakota. There was an open war.
Right, yeah.
we can keep running. We have to have some understanding.
Jack, did you insist on the closed shop?
No, we never insisted on the closed shop as being the, see, in 1934, demand for the closed shop was formally dropped.
Yeah.
Now, in the first section of the over-the-road motor agreement, as I recall, we told them that only people who were members of the union or those who were eligible for membership could be hired. It wasn't spelled out in the closed shop. Do you have the area agreements?
Not in front of me, but I don't think there's anything in there in the area agreement about the closed shop.
There isn't, per se. We never made a big stand on the closed shop anyway.
Right.
But we had it strong enough, as I recall, that the employer had to hire union men. We didn't spell out closed shop, close quote. We just said nobody but people belonging to the union going to work here or those are eligible to be members.
Right.
If you get out section one, it was cleverly written because we did not want to be a party in a way to lining up people in the union without any getting them any conditions.
Right.
But we wanted control, and we had it.
Yeah.
We had complete control of them terminals. There was no monkey business about that.
You didn't want to let the employer know that you had that kind of leverage.
Well, we had it in language which we could insist. Now, Farrell wrote the language,
yeah.
And it was cleverly written. And there was no arbitration clauses in it, if you notice, when you read it.
Yeah.
We didn't believe in that, and that's the way that went on.
I'll look that contract over then.
Yeah, you read it. It's kind of... If I recall, we had a manner in which we could insist that the men belonged to the union. They had a 30-day trial period that they could be worked, but they had to make immediate application to join the union, as I recall.
Yeah.
It wasn't spelled out like... And they had to call the hall, too, as I remember. Let me think now. I'm trying to think how we handled that. First, we had to accept the people that were on the payroll when we organized them.
Yeah.
And we had a clause in there, as I remember, not a clause, but in that number one, it was a pretty goddamn good one. Farrell says it's like an accordion. We can wrap it around anything we want. And we had an agreement. The agreement was written when he signed it, that when he hired anybody, and when he needed extra help, he had to call the union for help.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's in there, Lee.
Right, and if the union couldn't supply the people within a certain number of days and so on?
Well, no. We said they had to... we didn't give them all that latitude. We just told them that we were the bargaining agent.
Right.
And only people who were in the union or those who were eligible for membership in the union may be hired.
Oh.
And we had a proviso that when the employer wanted extra men, he couldn't go out on the street and recruit them. He had to call the union hall. Now, the only time that we allowed that, which is standard in any agreement, and I don't know how we wrote it there, was that in the event we didn't have men available, they could hire off the street.
Right.
But he had to make immediate application to get in the union.
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact language, but that's close to it, Earl.
Like one of the old-time... milk wagon drivers in Sioux Falls told me that they tried to get the closed shop during one of their strikes, their first strike, but they dropped it, when they found that the employer was resisting it. And he said that he found that it was kind of meaningless anyway, because as long as they had union recognition, that's all that they needed, because he said they were able to take care of any people that weren't union members. And he just got them down to the union hall, and after a couple of meetings, they had them signed up.
Well, in the original demands in Minneapolis, we had a clause in there for the closed shop.
Yeah.
But even before we got into the real, just a minute. Thank you. Anyway, even before we got into the final stretches, this is prior to the first strike in 1934 in May, after the coal strike. I remember one of the big things the employers had been pumping up about the closed shop.
Right. Yeah.
And we withdrew it. And Carl Skoglund explained, he said, the closed shop, if we can't convince the men on the job that they should belong to the union, and if we can't convince a non-union member to join the union, then we're not much informed as far as the union is concerned. And we're not going to break our back trying to get people to be automatically in the union, so we had the privilege of collecting dues. Carl says, we'll control the job, and anybody who's not on the job won't last very long.
And that's exactly what this old timer told me.
That's exactly the theory.
Yeah.
That if we can't get Joe Blow, who's a non-union guy, off the job, he deserves to stay, was Carl's opinion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there ain't many of them that stayed, Early.
Yeah. Jack, now the kind of get off onto something else. Did you remember the Sioux City Unionist, a newspaper that was...
Yes, yes.
Was that a 383 newspaper?
No, no. It was an organ of the Central Labor Union.
Central Labor Union.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I saw that referred to in the Northwest Organizer.
Yeah. We had a good friendly relationship with the editor of it. Very good. It was the official paper for the Trades Labor Assembly of Sioux City, Iowa.
Oh, okay. Okay. I don't know if I ever want to take a look at that or not, but as I've been, talking to you and going through the Northwest Organizer, I've been reading quite a bit about what happened there in Sioux City. Pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, we had our days there.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Now in Sioux Falls, do you remember a newspaper that was called Vox, V-O-X? And then the second word is popular.
Vox Populi, voice of the people.
Yeah.
That's Latin.
Yeah. You ever remember seeing that paper?
Yes, but it's kind of vague in my mind.
I picked that up also from the Northwest Organizer.
Mm-hmm. And they had a Vox Populi column in the Unionist, too.
In the Unionist?
Yeah, there was a Vox Populi column there, the voice of the people, if I remember.
You mean in the Sioux City Unionist?
Yep.
Oh.
They had a Vox Populi column there.
Oh. See, this Sioux Falls paper now, the Northwest Organizer said they're talking about Fouts and Johnson being convicted in Sioux Falls.
Uh-huh.
And the article reads, this is what the Vox Populi, a weekly paper published in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, states about the recent frame-up of Fouts and Johnson. And they go on to discuss the case, so...
Mm-hmm.
I can't find that paper anywhere.
Well, now, it's vague in my mind, and I don't know if it was an official paper of the Sioux Falls Central Labor Union. I'm inclined to believe not. I think it was some independent person or group that put that out and called it the voice of the people. I think that's Vox Populi is the Latin phrase for voice of the people.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Hmm?
wouldn't have been the Stalinists, would it?
Oh, hell no. No.
They were pretty active there in Sioux Falls, I understand.
Well, I never encountered them much.
They were working mainly with the farmers, Jack.
Yeah.
And
they were usually about a day late and a little bit short on these things.
Yeah.
Right now, I come across the other day a critique on the Teamster Union. And they quote Lance Campa and a couple of other people, Joe Malday, who wrote the worst, rottenest book about Hoffa that I've read. And they're critical, very critical of TDU, the Teamsters for a Decent Union. Oh, yes. It's about a 25-page thing. It's apparently written by a guy who, his name is David, D-A-V-I-D.
Yeah.
Capital L-I, D as in David, D as in David, L-E, Little. And it's a long thesis, The Crisis in the Teamster Union. Now, the guy's had some experience in the industry, you can see that. But he's writing from the standpoint of a perfect way that real political people who sit back and draw ideas about how unions should operate and how they should run, and they don't go that way. Now, they criticize TDU for not being involved with the employers. Well, Jesus Christ, TDU is not the bargaining agent.
Yeah.
If you and I were representing TDU and come up to Luggage and Buggy's Cartage Company and told them we wanted to talk about the men in the barn, they'd say, who the hell are you? Get out of here.
Yeah.
But what they're doing, they're arousing the ranks to stand up and fight. And I tell you, it takes a lot of balls to stand up in some of them unions and fight that corrupt your leadership. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I just was kind of wondering if you had any input on that.
No, I remember the sheet, and I know that there was a Vox Populi column or part or page in the Unionist, the Sioux City Unionist.
I wasn't aware of that paper at all, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found this reference today when I was going through some more of the Northwest Organizer.
What do you do, have photocopies of them?
Yeah, well, it's on microfilm, Jack.
Oh.
And I have the...
Where is that available on microfilm?
From the Minnesota Historical Society.
Oh, I see. And then you've got a machine to read it?
Yeah, I have to read it in our public library.
Oh, I get you now, yeah.
They have a printer down there, so
mm-hmm.
I see something that I'm interested in, I just...
Does it work? Can you get anything out of them clear prints?
Oh, yeah.
You can? The one we've got here, it's horrible.
Oh.
Geez, you go in there and you can't hardly read what you copy.
Well, this is very good.
Yeah, that's good.
And,
they had a pretty good one in Minneapolis.
Yeah, the one at the...
public library.
Well, I've been at the Historical Society.
Uh-huh.
And they have a very good reader there. They've got some different lenses that you can actually read an entire page.
Oh, yeah?
Using the
that would be fine.
The one we've got here in Bismarck isn't that specific.
No, the one they've got down here, they're sectional.
Yeah.
You have to read part of it, and then you got to adjust it up, and you lose it, and all that monkey business.
Yeah, but if you'd like to read some of that, you can get it on interlibrary loan, Jack.
They can? I tried to do that here, and they said nothing doing. Maybe with the State Historical. I was trying to get the papers out of Minneapolis.
Well, I don't know about which, not all papers are on microfilm,
Yeah, they are in Minneapolis.
And
for a while, you could have this library borrow them from the Minneapolis library, but they abandoned that practice.
Well, I don't know about yours, but my libraries here are participating in that.
Uh-huh.
All I have to do is go down to our library in Bismarck. I don't even have to go down. I can just call them on the telephone.
Yeah, that's what I used to do. But now I was trying to develop some background on the Minneapolis 34 strike.
Yeah.
And Randy First, you probably heard of him.
Yeah.
he wrote a goddamn article there, and it was all distorted, that he quotes Harry as telling him that.
Who wrote this article?
Randy First.
Yeah,
Randy, R-A-N-D-Y is his first name.
Right.
And F-U-R-S-T. Now, he's married to Jillian First.
Yeah.
And she's a woman from England. She speaks with a decided British accent. And he was a reporter for, and still is, for the Minneapolis Star.
Oh, okay.
And he used to do a lot of writing. And he was commenting on the 50th anniversary of Floyd Olson's death.
Oh, yeah.
And he made some, oh, God damn it, it just upset me. I think I've got them photocopied. I may pass them on to you. And so I was trying, and this is as late as a year ago, and they told me then that they don't do that here anymore. And because before that, all I had to do was call the library, tell them the names of the papers in Minnesota and Minneapolis that I wanted, and they'd call me when they come in. That's the way they used to do it. They don't do it no more.
Oh, that's too bad.
It is too bad.
Now, in the case of, you might try them again, because in the case of Minnesota now, they charge a dollar.
Well, they charge a nominal fee here, too.
Yeah.
They pay the postage or whatever. Who cares about that on a bill? What's a little thing like that on a big ship?
Well, anyway, I guess maybe I'm running out of time, Jack, so I was going to try to get in North Dakota tonight, but we'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah, what time was that going to be?
Well, I'm not too sure now. I've got some things coming up here.
Well, don't strain yourself. It won't be for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. How about October 31st? How's that?
Okay, that's good.
Same time?
Okay, same thing.
October 31st.
All right. At 8 o'clock my time.
Right.
10 o'clock your time.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, Jack.
You bet.